From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Governor Ron DeSantis has signed legislation to address rising condo fees after efforts to make the building safer made some worry they couldn't afford to stay in their homes.
As you implement legislation, of course, you begin to see what the challenges may be. And of course, it became clear that we needed more flexibility.
Also this week, the victims of the Surfside condo collapse are remembered.
There's a long way to go. This is something that really was a big hole in our community and will remain so, I think, for many, many years to come.
And Florida is on track to tie the record for the most executions in a year since 1976.
I think there are some crimes that are just so horrific, the only appropriate punishment is the death penalty.
I'm Regan McCarthy. This is Capitol Report. Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation this week aimed at changing the government structure of condo associations and giving them more options to finance condo inspections and repairs. The legislation came after condo owners around the state expressed concerns about costs associated with new inspection and repair requirements passed after the Surfside condo collapse in Miami. WFSU's Tristan Wood spoke with Miami Republican Representative Vicky Lopez about what impact her legislation will have now that it's become law.
First off, can you talk to me a little bit about why HB 913 was needed?
So I believe, you know, when we take a look at the goal, which has always been and it continues to be, of course, protecting life and ensuring that a tragedy like Surfside never happens again in the state of Florida. But it became, you know, those last two bills actually, you know, as you implement legislation, of course, you begin to see what the challenges may be. And of course, it became clear that we needed more flexibility in order to ensure that condominium residents could stay in their homes and not be forced out by the burdening cost that were associated with meeting the requirements of the original two laws. So this became a critical piece of legislation because after the implementation of both Senate Bill 4D and Senate Bill 154, it became painfully clear, unfortunately, that the cost related to living in these condominiums, particularly very old condominiums, was going to require more flexibility.
So on that, your average condo owner or resident in Florida, what are the most important things for them to understand about this bill that was signed into law?
So I guess the most important thing was currently, before Senate Bill, House Bill 913, they were required to begin reserving for their structural integrity components. There are eight of them. And so they were required to start in 2025, which would have meant that their monthly condo fees would have naturally increased. At the same time, many of those buildings might have been reaching the 30-year mark, which would have signaled the need for a milestone inspection. And most of those milestone inspections do result in a need for what we know as special assessments to make any repairs that are required to ensure that the building remains structurally sound. So in many ways, and then, of course, there was the increase in property insurance. So in many ways, it was like a perfect storm. Condo residents were being met with all of these costs all at once. So the most important part of House Bill 913 is that now in lieu of reserves, a condo association can actually take out a credit line in the same amount as is required by their structural integrity reserve study, which means then that condo fees will not be increased on a monthly basis, at least not for the reserve requirement. And that is going to bring extraordinary relief to many condominium associations who were going to be forced to have to increase monthly condo fees to meet that requirement.
Generally, it seems to me from what you're saying that this bill is about striking the balance, about making sure another Surfside doesn't happen while dealing with like the business realities and the financial realities of how condos operate. Do you think there's going to be more bites of the apple needed next year to deal with problems, or do you think your bill is going to provide the relief condo owners need.
I always say that a bill of this magnitude that has such a statewide impact, and because it's complex and complicated, I always believe there'll have to be another bite to the apple. Because as they implement House Bill 913, we will undoubtedly understand that there might be other challenges. One in particular that I'm looking at to try to resolve is the kind of new condominium framework, which is called the hotel condos, and what goes on in those facilities, because they're very different than a standalone condominium. And so they have different challenges that I think need to be addressed. There's always tweaks. I think we've done a lot in the last 3 years, but I'm always open to taking another bite at the apple.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tristan. It was a pleasure.
This week marked 4 years since the 12-story condominium known as Champlain Towers South collapsed in Surfside. WLRN's Sophia Zaran spoke with community members as they gathered to remember the 98 people who died in the tragedy.
For some mourners, the fourth anniversary of the deadly collapse of Champlain Towers South felt heavier than previous years. Dozens gathered near the site in Surfside to pay respect to the 98 who died. Devin Gonzalez was 16 when she, along with her mother and father, was inside the condominium building as it came down. Her father was killed.
We all still feel. There's this assumption from people and outsiders that aren't a part of the Surfside community that because we received compensation after the collapse, our lives must be fine now. But what so many fail to see is that money came at a cost of everything I ever knew and we ever knew.
Many of the speakers openly aired their frustration with the lack of answers as to what caused the building to collapse. Fran Sebchak attended the ceremony to honor her late nephew, Gary Cohen.
I thought it was a beautiful ceremony and a paying tribute to the people, but there's a long way to go. This is something that really was a big hole in our community and will remain so, I think, for many, many years to come.
At the end of the ceremony, the names of the 98 lives lost were read. I'm Sophia Sarran in Miami.
The state of Florida carried out its seventh execution of 2025 on Tuesday. An eighth is already scheduled, which would tie the record for the most executions in 1 year since the death penalty was reinstated back in the 70s. Margie Menzel looks into what's behind the change.
Philip Barnes, August 3rd. 2023. Michael Dwayne Zack, October 3rd, 2023.
Outside the governor's mansion, members of a group called Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty are gathered, reading the names of people recently executed in the state of Florida. It is June 24th at 6 p.m., and within the hour, Thomas Godinez will be added to that list. He was sentenced to death for the brutal rape and murder of Michelle McGrath in 1994.
In times like these, we come to God, the Eternal, whom we know in different ways and by different names.
Godinez's execution is Florida's seventh this year. And already, Governor Ron DeSantis has signed an eighth warrant, tying the record for the most death warrants signed in a year since 1976, when the death penalty was reinstated by the U.S. Supreme Court. For Marianne Hoffman, who is part of the group praying, that's far too many. She points to a recent op-ed published in the Orlando Sentinel that raised questions about how the state decides whose warrant to sign next.
All the appeals for that person have been done by lawyers, and so now the person is considered execution ready and then gets the death warrant. But then what the article says is there's not much transparency in how this happens.
DeSantis has said he believes the death penalty serves an important purpose.
I support capital punishment because I think there are some crimes that are just so horrific, the only appropriate punishment is the death penalty. And I know there's some people that disagree with that, and that's fine, but that's my judgment.
DeSantis said this on May 15th at a press event in Dade City.
This stuff is just overwhelmingly sadistic. It shocks your conscience. And that's just not the way that a civilized society can function. So part of it is an appropriate punishment. Part of it is it expresses the outrage of the community. Because if you do something less than that, then potentially you're sending a signal that, yeah, it's bad, but not as bad as it could have been. No, these are the worst of the worst.
But records showed DeSantis signed just one death warrant for a prisoner executed last year. So what's behind the current ramp up? Political analyst Susan McManus says, for one thing, violent crime is in the news.
Looking over some of the polling and news coverage of late, there's just been a spike of interest in violent crimes. And that's showing up in polls, and more people are focusing on that. Some of it has to do with the deportation of criminals with violent records. I think it's on the minds of people more than it has been in the past.
Another possibility is that DeSantis hopes to stir up more support from his base as he looks ahead to his next political ambition once his term as governor ends. But McManus says the death penalty isn't as much of a red meat issue for Republicans as it used to be. A majority of Americans still support capital punishment, she says, but not as many.
Younger generation is very much against it, so you get a generational split. But also you're seeing somewhat of a religious split. And the interesting argument there is people who say, well, I can't be pro-life on the abortion issue and be pro-death in the death penalty situation.
A 2024 Gallup poll shows 53% of respondents were in favor of the death penalty in a murder case, while 43% were opposed. The next state execution is scheduled to take place in July. I'm Margie Menzel.
A record high 80% of Americans believe the country is divided on important values. This divide is not unusual, but the portion of people who agree that we can't agree on key values is as high as it's been in the three decades it's been measured by the Gallup poll. Just scroll through social media if you need any evidence of how far apart Floridians may be on issues like immigration, education, and the environment. WLRN's Tom Hudson spoke with Shankar Vedantam, host of NPR's Hidden Brain, about the science behind human emotional states and how we can approach those moments when we get hot-tempered talking about important values.
How does our emotional state govern how we are approaching some of these very divisive, oftentimes conflict-oriented conversations or moments within ourselves or even with others, trying to kind of navigate this hyper-politicized world that we've created?
You know, Tom, our emotions in some ways act like a lens. They basically shape our perceptions of the world. They shape what we see. And emotions in some ways are designed to drive us towards some kind of action. So the emotion of sadness, for example, might cause us to withdraw. The emotion of anger might cause us to approach something. All emotions in some ways are designed to both give us signals about what the world is telling us, but also signals about how we should behave. They're triggers for action. And so when we are in a certain hot emotional state, it's not surprising that when we look at the world looks different than it would be if we were in a different emotional state.
Describe that gap. Researchers refer to it as the empathy gap between kind of what I'll call logic and reason and some other heightened emotional state.
Yeah, I'm going to be talking about this in my upcoming visit to Florida for the Perceptions Tour of Hidden Brain this weekend. It goes back to the work of a researcher named George Lowenstein at Carnegie Mellon University. Many years ago, he noticed that the way he felt when he was in a hot state felt very surprising to him when he was in a cold state. So, for example, let's say you're very angry or you're feeling very upset about something. It's very difficult for you to imagine how you yourself will feel 6 hours later or 6 weeks later when you're in a cold state, when you're much calmer. And similarly, when you're in a calm state, when you are not agitated, it's very difficult for you to put yourself in your own shoes when you're in a hot state. And so this idea has come to be called the hot-cold empathy gap, which is just as we have problems sometimes empathizing with others, it turns out we also have problems empathizing with ourselves, that we don't fully understand how we will behave when we are in a different emotional state.
Yeah. What role does the willingness to be self-reflective play to recognize maybe that wasn't behavior or a social media post that I'm particularly proud of now?
When we're in a self-reflective state, it usually means we're in a cold state. We're basically thinking, we're reflecting, we're open to ideas, we're taking in information. We're not in the hot emotional state where we might fire off a social media post that we might later come to regret. So I think the answer to the hot-cold empathy gap is certainly to be more reflective, to be more mindful, to be more aware of what we're doing. But really, that's another way of saying, try and get in a cold state if you really want to think about what you do before you do it.
And I'm also thinking of just more simple, I suppose, everyday pedestrian examples of being able to fire off that social media post, the hot take.
Yes.
It's literally
yes.
called a hot take, right, Shankar?
Exactly.
And,
yes.
and for a reason, I suppose. And finding the value in being more reflective versus getting your voice in there and to get that hot take out there into social media on the platform.
Exactly. And I think there are mechanisms to use technology to help us now to basically say, you know, when you fire off an email, some email platforms will say, we will delay sending this message, even though you have hit send for 2 minutes, so that you have a chance to think about whether it's a message you actually want to send. You can do this on some social media platforms. Let's say you're very angry and you want to fire off a social media post. One thing you can do is write the social media post, but don't send it right away. Send it 20 minutes from now.
I appreciate that. And I know I have a draft folder full of hot takes that I do not send to folks. I will admit to that. But I also know that, candidly, the algorithm of our social media footprints don't reward
yes.
our cold states, do they?
Yes. No, they don't. And yeah. I think this is one of the problems, I think, with our technology here. So many social media platforms reward hot takes, they reward outrage, they reward sort of very short-tempered outbursts with people. But I think that's what so much of social media has become. It's become sort of an ongoing spectacle. And it's really not something that lends itself to the kind of reasoned conversation, debate, reflection that you often hear, especially on a public radio station.
Indeed, right? We know conflict is the source of good drama, but civility is where understanding lies. So how do we think as journalists, Shankar, as media folks, you and I, but also audience members who may be listening to this and folks we'll talk to and who are calling or emailing, how do we encourage that return or embrace of cold state as opposed to running toward the hot state and wanting almost to stay in that agitated state?
Mm. You know, one thing that I think is actually very helpful is that many listeners have heard the term intellectual humility, which is to say that remind myself from time to time that I don't know everything, that other people, in fact, might know more about a subject than I do. Fewer people, I think, have heard about the term moral humility. And the idea of moral humility is that even though people who disagree with me might have very different moral concerns, moral humility says my moral concerns and preferences should not take priority or precedence over your moral concerns and considerations. So if something upsets you, if you feel something has moral valence, but I don't really think it has moral valence, humility in terms of moral humility tells me, even though I don't feel what you're feeling, I need to respect the fact that what you feel might be authentic. So many of the disagreements and the passionate quarrels that we have stem from the fact that we are unable to recognize or acknowledge that the concerns of other people are valid, right? So we basically feel that our concerns are extremely valid, and we are outraged that other people don't recognize the intensity and fervor with which we feel our concerns. But we don't extend that to others. We don't basically say, okay, if you care about a different issue, an issue that I don't care much about, but you're saying that this is important to you, I'm willing to concede that this is important to you. I'm willing to concede that this is something that matters to you. And I think when you do this, it takes some of the sting out of the conflicts that we have with each other, because we recognize when we exercise moral humility that the people who disagree with us are not disagreeing with us because they're bad people or because they're stupid people or because they're uninformed, but just because they have different moral criteria for how to judge the world. Now, this is easier said than done. Just like intellectual humility, it's one thing to know that it's a good thing to practice. Not always easy to practice moral humility.
Shankar, really fascinating. And thank you for the conversation and for what you do each week on Hidden Brain.
Thank you so much, Tom. It's been a pleasure.
That was Shankar Vedantam, host of NPR's Hidden Brain with WLRN's Tom Hudson. Soon, wild animals that find their path blocked by the state's busiest interstate will have a new way to migrate. WUSF's Steve Newborn reports Interstate 4 is getting its first overpass that will help panthers, bears, and other critters cross one of the biggest barriers to the Florida Wildlife Corridor.
The construction site is a forlorn patch of weeds in Polk County. It's sandwiched between a warehouse on one side and Florida Polytechnic's futuristic main building on the other. Bisecting it all is traffic choking Interstate 4. This is not a place you want to be, even less so if you're a bear or panther trying to get to the other side.
So this is the first dedicated wildlife crossing overpass in the state of Florida.
Brent Setchell is a design engineer with the Florida Department of Transportation.
It's going to be 44 foot wide and have noise walls on both sides, 8 foot tall.
Animals will cross on dirt and grass with a view of the busy highway blocked.
And then on the outside, when you're driving by, it'll have impressions of different animals on there. So it'll have a deer, a bobcat, a panther, and a bear on there.
Those depictions are the reason why this is being constructed. The highway is a coast-to-coast blockade to the migration of wildlife up and down the state. Nature preserves are on both sides of the interstate here where the overpass is being built.
This is the best opportunity we have to preserve this corridor, and this is the last threat really in Polk County to be able to cross wildlife from south to north. This is our last chance.
Just a few miles to the east is an underpass that was created several years ago when a new interchange was built just north of Winter Haven. The noise and vibration from the road above deters many critters from approaching it. That's why the overpass is being built.
So this is the I-4. I call this the Western Green Swamp Crossing, but it basically connects the Hiloche Wildlife Management Area on both sides of the road.
It flows under the busy highway as huge trucks and endless rows of cars scurry to and from Tampa and Orlando. This is the only undercrossing on this part of I-4, although another one further east is being planned. On the east side of Orlando, three crossings were built when I-4 was widened several years ago. The tale of a bear who traveled from Highlands County and tried to get to the north was the genesis for the idea of a Florida Wildlife Corridor. That's an ambitious project to connect natural areas so animals can roam freely throughout the state. The bear tried several times but never made it across I-4, so back south he went. Nicole Moniz of the State Transportation Department says the underpass was designed with a creek flowing through it to allow the passage of aquatic wildlife.
And so we do have on videos alligators utilizing this as well, and other aquatic creatures, so it's really neat to see the terrestrial versus the aquatic species that are using this.
There are more than 200 wildlife underpasses in Florida. The state is building them in areas where it is preserving land for the wildlife corridor. Jared Perdue is secretary of the Florida Department of Transportation.
It's not actually that costly. It just takes somebody caring about it.
During the Corridor Connect conference held recently in Orlando, he said road planners are more actively considering wildlife crossings.
Wildlife connectivity has become a big part of that, and we've even pushed that guidance out to designers. And so, like, if they're designing a bridge or something like that, making sure if it is an important area for wildlife that we're providing the space for them to get underneath or over or whatever it takes.
The crossings can prevent collisions with wildlife on major highways. Just the day before our visit, two motorcyclists hit a 6-foot alligator in the middle of I-4 near Orlando. They were thrown from their bikes, but survived. The alligator? Well, he was not so lucky. I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.
You are listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Regan McCarthy. Finally this week. This time of year, young shorebird families along Central Florida's coasts are starting to take flight. But species like the American oyster catcher are struggling with habitat loss. As Central Florida Public Media's Molly Durick reports.
I'm on a boat in the Mosquito Lagoon, where Linda Walters, a marine biology professor at the University of Central Florida, is leading a small crew working on what's called a living shoreline.
It is the least destructive way to protect a shoreline.
Walters calls it low-tech, using more natural materials like native plants and biodegradable wave breakers to stabilize the shore against erosion.
As opposed to using any sort of hard armoring, which would be a seawall or putting really large rocks out.
Seawalls can also help fend off erosion, but one big drawback to that hardening approach is it can also harm valuable wildlife habitat. For oyster catchers, a species Florida classifies as threatened, the native mangrove trees and Spartina marsh grass being planted along this shoreline form one piece of a delicate puzzle, or to steal a term from Walters, a habitat mosaic.
The oyster catchers, they can use a living shoreline as the high ground that doesn't get wet at high tide.
Oyster catchers also need to be near their favorite food. That means oyster reefs, another critically imperiled lagoon habitat Walters works to restore.
That's the biggest kind of like existential threat to the species. Is there going to be habitat for them to live in?
That's Shiloh Schulte, a senior shorebird scientist at Manomet Conservation Sciences and coordinator of a national oyster catcher working group.
Shorebirds as a species group are declining rapidly, and oyster catchers are one of the few that's not.
Schulte says nationally, there are nearly 15,000 oyster catchers today, up from about 10,000 in 2008. That may not sound like a huge jump, but with populations declining for more than 200 other North American bird species, conservationists count it as a win. That said, it's a delicate balance. In Florida, oyster catchers are managing to hold steady despite shrinking habitat. Janelle Brush leads seabird and shorebird research at the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission.
Habitat losses, it's on my mind a lot. That's the most critical threat that I think we're facing.
Habitat loss from things like storms, rising high tides that flood out nests, and human interference.
The more developed an area you have, the less suitable habitat that you have that's available for species like oyster catchers to nest.
Just up the coast, about 25 miles north from the Mosquito Lagoon, construction crews in Ormond-by-the-Sea are building a buried seawall covered up by sand dunes and vegetation. It's what Stetson University's Jason Evans would call a hybrid mechanism to combat erosion.
Trying to figure out how to slow and stabilize erosion within a natural environment that naturally erodes. And that's like the really big dilemma.
A dilemma Evans helps coastal communities to solve. Evans says while theoretically it makes sense to want to hold a shoreline in place to protect the property behind it.
Just as soon as you stabilize something, there's going to be a follow-on consequence somewhere else.
Like two potential shorebird habitat.
We've simplified these ecosystems, right? We've gone in, destroyed enormous amounts of coastal wetlands in Florida for putting in these seawalls.
Evan says hybrid solutions like the buried seawall can be an effective middle ground. Right now, researchers at UCF are working on a model to help determine where in Florida living shorelines might work best. Meanwhile, the future of federal funding that's long-fueled oyster catcher restoration work is in limbo. But Brush with FWC is hopeful. She says in the world of conservation, uncertainty is nothing new.
There's always opportunities. You just have to look for them.
In Orlando, I'm Molly Durig.
Before this story aired, Manomet senior shorebird scientist Shiloh Schulte died in a helicopter crash while working in Alaska. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Margie Menzel, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Molly Durig, Tom Hudson, Steve Newborn, and other public radio reporters throughout the state. Technical assistance for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Regan McCarthy. Join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.